Good morning. Good afternoon, Council.
Good afternoon.
Matter of U.S. versus Barrett. Ms. Horton, you ready?
I am, Your Honor. Thank you.
Okay.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. Rachel Horton on behalf of appellant Michael Barrett. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay.
Mr. Barrett was convicted after officers who engaged in well-documented and serious misconduct participated in fatally flawed trials. This court has twice said that Mr. Barrett's prosecutions deserve further attention, but he was not given an evidentiary hearing. The district court did not grapple with the many serious factual and legal issues that are before this court. It merely adopted the government's brief.
By what concerns me, obviously this case is disturbing, and my guess is that Mr. Zosmer, as I do in his professionalism, he is perhaps as disturbed about the conduct.
I'm hearing a feedback. I really can't understand the argument.
Any better?
I'm hearing the argument twice.
Well, maybe it'll take you two times to understand it, Bob.
Very true.
Any better now? I don't know. We had this problem before. You still getting the echo?
It's not an echo.
Yourself,
it's
it might
it's
help.
A complete replay.
Well, when I take these off,
I'll try it.
Okay.
I
think
now Judge McKee, we can't hear Judge McKee now.
I'm good now. Okay, it went away. I'm sorry about that.
Any better?
It's fine
now.
Oh, okay, all right, okay. These usually are a lot better, but I was going to ask you, Mr. Zellner, thank you for letting us know that. When I read this case, and as I was saying that my guess is, knowing Mr. Zosmer's professionalism as I do, that he's probably perhaps as concerned about the conduct of Officers Kudzik and McConnell as you are. But let me, I was reminded of an argument I used to love to make when I was an assistant USA and I had a case that involved some really problematic witnesses. And that is, tell the jury at the end of the case, you know, you may have reason to doubt their testimony. I understand that. Forget about everything they said. Don't consider anything they said and what's left. So let's do that here. Let's take Kudzik and McConnell out of the case. In terms of the raid on the house and the constructive possession, you have Gorman and Kovacs, who basically testified to everything that McConnell and Kudzik did. They were there. It's constructive possession. The keys found in your client's pocket. I don't know if it was Gorman or Kovacs who found the key, but it wasn't Kudzik or McConnell. And then you've got the incident with the car that they don't need Kudzik or McConnell to establish, and the drugs found in the car. So given that, and we can get to the consecutive concurrent sentence in a while, later on, given what happened here, and you're right, it's disgusting, but why doesn't that, why should that have any impact whatsoever on the underlying conviction? Because Kudzik and McConnell were not really material to the conviction.
Your Honor, we respectfully disagree because these trials were about officer credibility. As you pointed out, the key—
Let's assume Kudzik and McConnell lied. You got the trash pull, you've got, I think it was Gorman who was there on the trash pull, maybe it was Kovacs. Again, when they go in and they find the gun behind the television, it's not Kudzik and McConnell. How does it help you?
The government relies on Officer Gorman's testimony. However, the defense did not realize at the time that it needed to press Officer Gorman and challenge him. He could not have been in every single room at all times during the apartment search. And he admitted when he testified that he said that evidence was recovered, quote, in his presence. And that simply meant that he was on scene, not that he had firsthand knowledge of the evidence recovery.
Say it again, please.
When Officer Gorman testified, he admitted at trial that it was his unit's practice for the supervisor to say, as they testified, that evidence was testified, quote, in his presence. And so even if he didn't have firsthand knowledge, he would testify based on what he heard from his boots on the ground officers who had allegedly recovered particular pieces of evidence.
But I thought in his presence was when he saw actually what, he may not have been the officer who was called to testify, and I thought actually he did testify as to that. But wasn't he there and he saw what was going on?
No, he was present on the scene on the day of the apartment search. But at JA 366, he explains that in his presence is just shorthand for him being on the scene. And so the defense had no notice that it needed to really press which of the officers was relying on hearsay versus which of the officers recovered evidence. And so, for example, the key, which you mentioned, and it was Officer Kovacs who allegedly, in the prosecution's closing, it invited the jury to speculate about who possessed these two guns that were attributed to Mr. Barrett. They resulted in a 60-month consecutive sentence. And we block quote that in our brief. The inference that he asked the jury to draw is simply because we think that the other two guns belong to the co-defendant. We think that these two guns belong to Mr. Barrett. That is
because if you've got constructive possession, if the person, the client, has the access and control to the premises in which the gun is found, he's got the key, isn't that enough to get constructive possession of the gun that he set?
It's not, Your Honor. Under this court's precedent in Brown, which is, let me give you the site because I don't think it's in the brief. It's 3 F3rd at 680 to 684. This court has explored whether a key is sufficient. And even for individuals who lived in the apartment and had a key, it's insufficient to show constructive possession. So the government needs more. There is also a defense witness who testified that she had not given Mr. Barrett the key. And this was not his apartment. It was a friend's apartment. And so the government's assertions that constructive possession are well-founded here are not taken well once we dissect Officer Gorman's testimony.
Ms. Horton?
Yes.
Isn't your real problem in this case the standard which you have to establish in 2255H1, that no reasonable fact finder would have found the movement guilty of the offense?
Thank you for raising that, Your Honor, because obviously the parties disagree about the rule of decision here. The district court did not indicate what standard of review it was adopting. And our position is that 2255A provides the rule of decision in federal habeas cases. And so on remand, we would show a Brady violation since we have gone through this circuit's gatekeeping function.
How would the... Well, the Brady violation, wouldn't you have to show that the government was aware of the illegal activity of the officers, of Kudrick and McConnell? And is it clear that the government knew what these folks were up to at the time of this trial?
Well, the officers were part of the prosecution team. And so under the Supreme Court's precedent, their knowledge is imputed by law to the prosecutor. And so the prosecutor...
Officers. Are you saying that Kudrick and McConnell had a Brady obligation come forward and say, well, you know, by the way, I've been engaging in this illegal activity that you need to let defense counsel know about? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, Your Honor. The prosecutor himself has the Brady obligation to determine information that's in the possession of the police. And so here, since these were the boots on the ground investigating police officers, and they knew that they were engaged in misconduct that predated the trial and was contemporaneous with the trial, they needed to be cross-examined about that information.
How would they have known? None of that information was forthcoming until after the trial. And there are cases which Mr. Zausner cited in his brief that pretty clearly indicate that this would not become Brady material under the circumstances.
It is Brady material, Your Honor, because the police officers know what they do. And so we as the defense don't have to rely on the police officers having some crisis of conscience and admitting on the stand what they have done. The information was in their possession. And so once the defense...
When you say their possession, are you referring to Gorman and Kovacs?
I'm referring...
Kovacs knew what Kudrick and McConnell would do.
Yes, Your Honor. As to the first search, it was Kujic, McDonald, and Bologna, all of whom have been disciplined by the Philadelphia Police Department. And Kujic and McDonald have fabricated and planted evidence and fabricated probable cause for search warrants. And so the defense has a right to cross-examine at trial when officers are engaged in that conduct. And, you know, how would that cross-exam go, right? You know,
they would not have relied upon, had they known, the prosecutor known, they wouldn't have put Kujic and McConnell on the witness stand. They'd have used Gorman and Kovacs and other people who were not tainted. But I think that doesn't matter because the conduct of Kujic and McConnell is accredited to or charged to other police officers anyhow because they're part of the investigation that under Brady, I'm not sure I agree with this, that under Brady, officers have an obligation to disclose anything which is exculpatory. If you take that to a logical conclusion, you're suggesting Kujic and McConnell have an obligation to come forward and say, hey, folks, I've been involved in some stuff I got to tell you about because you got an obligation with Brady to let folks know that I'm doing this. I don't know of any case that would suggest that.
Well, thank you for letting me clarify that, Your Honor, because it's our position that the government prosecutor has the Brady obligation. And so he needs to talk to each of the officers and understand what exculpatory material evidence that officer knows about or has.
Let's suppose that the prosecutor did that. Do you think that McDonald or Kujic is going to acknowledge at the time of trial that they had planted evidence in prior cases? The answer to that is going to be no. So
right, and there was a Brady violation.
There was no way to discover that. And the point I raised that the government has raised in their brief that you did not respond to in reply brief was it's not Brady material. It's not Giglio material.
It is absolutely Giglio material. The government does not have a safe hatch because the prosecutor was well-meaning. Under the Supreme Court precedent,
not well-meaning, he just did not know.
Right, and under Giglio, there is not an obligation that the prosecutor himself knew of the misconduct. And I believe that's in Kyles v. Whitney, when the police officers who were boots on the ground knew it, and they had an opportunity
Which officers are you referring to? The entire investigative team or specifically the officers who were subsequently indicted? Which officers?
As to the first trial, it is Kujic, McDonald, and Bologna. As to the second trial, those are the officers who were indicted in the RICO action and our interpretation.
All of them were acquitted except for Walker.
Right, but the government doesn't defend that verdict at this point.
I understand that, but we're getting to the question of whether or not this is Brady or Giglio material.
Under Giglio, there's not a requirement that there have been a conviction. And so, in Giglio—
I understand, but there has to be, quote, material. There can't be an act that McDonald or Kujic has never confessed to that you can therefore post hoc label as Giglio material. And that puts a burden, that's a burden that's impossible for any prosecution team to know about.
Your Honor, the knowledge of the prosecutor himself is not the focus when the police
We understand that. That's not the point. We understand that.
Because in those cases where they say, the prosecutor says, well, maybe it was in the officer's file, not reduce the report, and I didn't know it was there, that's different. Clearly, there's an obligation to come forward with that anyhow. This is very different because you're suggesting, it's what my other questions tried to get to, you're suggesting there's an obligation on the part of the, we'll call them felons, the potential felons, to come forward and confess their criminality so that it can be disclosed to the defense counsel and to be as Brady material. And that, I don't know any case that goes that far. Mr. Sosmer suggests in his brief that the case is in fact to the contrary.
Your Honor, it's officers do not routinely plant evidence and then years later the defense finds out about it through some other mechanism. And so just like second 2255s are quite rare, the factual situation that we have here is very rare. So this court's cases in Wilson, for example, which is, I think it's in the brief, but let me give you the site in case it's not. It's 589 F3rd at 659. They talk about how the prosecution team, because it depends so integrally on the police officers and they are in a position where their misconduct impacts the defense so seriously, unlike a traditional witness, the police officers, the prosecution, with its superior knowledge and superior resources, they have to bear the burden when they have police officers who are engaged in misconduct.
They don't have the superior knowledge here. They had no idea that Kudrick and McConnell and Bumbiardi, what his name is, were doing this stuff.
But Kudrick and McDonald were part of the prosecution team, and Kudrick testified at trial. And Gorman relied on Kudrick and McDonald's actions and information that they provided to give his testimony. And so the trial was, I mean, there was no DNA, no fingerprints, no documents that tied Mr. Barrett to this apartment. This was a battle of credibility. And this court doesn't predict what a jury would.
We're going to circle it up. It was the key. And who was it who seized the key from his pocket?
It was Kovacs.
Okay. And Gorman said he saw that.
No, not that I, no, he didn't. He actually said that he was in a different room and okay. He heard someone say, "We've got a key." And he didn't Kovacs, know who that
Kovacs
was.
Kovacs testified that he found the key. And there's no allegation anywhere. In fact, you don't even make it that there's anything, any Giglio material that you could have cross-examined Kovacs on.
Can we switch gears for a minute? Before, whether or not this is Brady material, I'm not sure it's even appropriate to be talking about Brady because I'm not sure you've made it past the gatekeeping requirements. Why do you say that you have?
This court granted Mr. Barrett leave to file a second 2255. Right. And the 2244, which a court is familiar with, expressly excludes 2255 in subsection A from its language. 2244, which is about finality of the determination, is about 2254s because of federalism concerns and the deference that's owed to state court judgments. And so we look to the text of 2255 to determine what portions of 2244 have been incorporated. So when we look at subsection A, as I mentioned earlier, that's the standard for federal defendants who are moving for habeas relief. When we look to subsection H in 2255, the only reference is to a certification by the Court of Appeals. And so this court has held that for defendants who are seeking relief from a new rule of constitutional law that's been made retroactive, they do require that the defendant prove that on remand to the district court. And that makes sense because that defendant's sentence was not illegal at the time that it was imposed. However, for individuals who are seeking relief under H1, like Mr. Barrett, his entire theory of the case is that his sentence and conviction were tainted by constitutional violations. And so when we go back on remand, we should have to show a Brady violation or some other constitutional violation, just as you would in a traditional 2255A. And I'd also like to point out that
it isn't just the 2255H1. I'll ask that again. You're trying to avoid coming under that, but this is newly discovered evidence.
It's newly discovered evidence, but when you look to the language of H1, it talks about conditional language. It says the Court of Appeals shall certify the application to contain, and then it uses conditional language such as if proven and would be sufficient.
If proven and viewed, which means newly discovered evidence if proven and viewed, if a COA is properly granted as determined by the district court. And the district court in this case did not find that that existed. And that's why you're here.
Well,
I don't think you've made it through gatekeeping.
The text of 2255 does not refer to the district court. If Congress had wanted the district court to have a full-blown hearing, it would have made that clear in 2255.
What does if proven and viewed mean?
Well, it's a
where would it be proven and viewed?
It's a gatekeeping function that this court determines.
Your argument is if proven and viewed by the Court of Appeals on a request for a COA?
Yes, because H refers to the Court of Appeals.
That's what you're reading. That's what your interpretation is. Okay.
Yes. If 2244 and 2255 cross-referenced each other, we would have argued the clear and convincing evidence standard. But the textualist argument that we make in our reply brief is very strong that Congress intended to defer to state court judgments, but when there's a second 2255 at issue for federal defendants, we look to 2255A, which provides the rule of decision in habeas cases.
And so you did speak for some time and kind of going around in circles with the same questions and same answers. So let me, if you'll indulge us, and we'll hear from your colleague, Mr. Zosmer, and then we'll have you back in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Zosmer?
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, Your Honor. May it please the court. I'm Robert Zosmer on behalf of the government. There are several points that I would like to cover and, of course, answer the court's questions. But to explain why 2255H1 does apply here, why the district court has an obligation to make sure that 2255H1 is satisfied, and then finally talk about the evidence in this case, which clearly shows that not only that the 2255H1 standard is not met, but neither is the Brady standard. I will begin, however, by commenting on what Judge McKee said about the concern that we have regarding the police conduct. I think that's not debatable. You know, I think the court's very aware that I personally, as well as many of my colleagues, have spent many years, many unpleasant times dealing with the consequences of corruption in the Philadelphia Police Department. We take it very seriously. We try to prosecute the offenders. And as the court well knows, one of the pernicious effects of police corruption is that it often results in the need to dismiss cases of guilty people because you can no longer rely on the credibility of the officers involved. And so we've had so many of these issues over the years and have dealt with them. But what we've done in looking at other cases, and I think appropriately, is we look very carefully to see whether the conviction rests on the information of the tainted officers. Because what we also know is that the tainted officers, thankfully, as far as we know, are still the exception rather than the rule. The Philadelphia Police Department has thousands of dedicated officers who get up every day and do their best to faithfully enforce the law. And so we're not going to just throw out any conviction because one officer knew another officer who we now know may be problematic. So in this appeal, we're not focused on the second trial of Mr. Barrett. If that were the conviction, I have no doubt that that would be one of the dismissed cases, that trial rested completely on the testimony of officers who were later indicted by my office, even if they were acquitted. We would be very uncomfortable relying on that testimony. But he was actually mostly acquitted in that trial, maybe by a savvy jury. He was only convicted under 922G. It was a fully concurrent sentence that was imposed. And so unless the court has questions about it, we're really focused on the 2005 case because that's what drives this matter. And what the 2005 case is a matter that relies on credible officers, or at least we have no basis whatsoever then or now to say that Sergeant Gorman or Officer Kovacs or the other people involved have any credibility issue whatsoever. And that's where this case fails. And that's why we do maintain that this verdict should be preserved. In terms of the questions that I said I would address, first, 2255H1, that standard requiring clear and convincing evidence that no reasonable juror would acquit, would convict upon hearing the new evidence. That's very familiar to us and to the court. The Supreme Court has called that the actual innocence standard that applies in a number of contexts. And it's very difficult to reach, and it applies here. It plainly discusses newly discovered evidence, which is what we have. Now, there is an issue when the new claim involves Brady, and other courts, not this court, but have discussed the problem very thoughtfully, and we cite those cases in our briefs, because I can easily understand someone saying, well, wait, I went through the first 2255, and the government was still withholding evidence, and I didn't find out about that evidence till after my first 2255 was litigated. How can you now hold me to a worse standard? That's not fair. I understand that, and courts have understood that, and nevertheless, faithfully applied the clear language of 2255H1. The clearest discussion of this has been in the Ninth Circuit, in the Brown versus Mooney's case in 2018, which was cited in our briefs. Judge Simandl also, I think it was incorrectly cited in my colleague's reply brief. Judge Simandl agreed that 2255H1 has to apply in this context, despite the concern. Now, I also should say that that concern that you're learning about Brady information after the first 2255, it actually doesn't apply in this case. In this case, the key information is about Kujic. Kujic is the one who suffered the most accusations. He was accused of putting false information in search warrants. He was accused of paying an informant so that that informant could pay rent for a place that Kujic owned. All of that was actually known in 2009 and was disclosed by the government to Mr. Barrett's attorneys in 2009, and it was brought up in his direct appeal in this court. And this court acknowledged that that was not sufficient to affect the verdict because none of that information, then or now, was about the 2005 case, about any suggestion that Mr. Kujic had done anything wrong in this case. So we're really not in that troubling situation where you may have a Brady disclosure after the first 2255. But even if we were, the case law is unanimous that this 2255H1 standard has to apply. It was developed by Congress to assure finality in habeas litigation, and that's what it does. Now that leads to the second question, which is the whether this is binding on the district court or not. And the answer is it is. It's not just up to the Court of Appeals, as Ms. Horton suggests, to say that you meet that threshold and now it's a brand new ball game, you treat it as any other 2255. This court has repeatedly held that it still falls on the district court to assess whether the 2255H1 standard is met in order to allow any relief. And in fact, in this very case, I could actually say it's law of the case, because in this very case, Mr. Barrett was first given a certificate of appealability, or rather permission to proceed on the second 2255, back in 2017, in the matter that we're now arguing today. Judge Fisher was on that panel. It's at page 1768 of the appendix, which is the approval of going forward on a second or successive petition. And that very order on page 1768 correctly says, this is not a final call. It's still up to the district court as to whether 2255H1 is met. And the recent cases that confirm that, precedential decisions, the Peppers case in 2018, 899 F3rd 211, the Hoffner case, 870 F3rd 301, that's Third Circuit 2017, the Matthews case, 934 F3rd 296. Those are all cases just within the last 3 years in which the court has confirmed that it's still the district court's obligation to make sure the standard is met. I think I have the privilege, as I look at it, of losing on the merits every one of those cases in arguing to this court. But those matters did go back to the district court for the district court to then make the assessment. And most of those defendants I know did not receive relief, or were still litigating hundreds of those cases relating to the Davis decision in the Third Circuit. So now, Ms. Horton understandably focuses on the statutory language, that 2241 does look like, 2244 looks like it's mostly about state habeas matters. But the key is that in 2255H, it says that in a federal matter, this court has to certify that those criteria are met. And what it says is certify as provided in section 2244. And this court therefore has always incorporated the standards of 2244 with regard to second or successive federal petitions. And in fact, this court has explained at length why it's still up to the district court. This court has explained that this court is given a limited amount of time to rule on whether a second or successive petition should go forward. This court does not hear evidence. It merely reviews the papers. And that's why we do have the fuller inquiry that takes place by the district court. So for these reasons, the clear and convincing standard is what applies here, that actual innocent standard that has to be met.
Let me ask you a question about the COA that's relevant to this case. Was it misstated in your opinion?
I believe so, Your Honor. And in fact, the defendant did not ask the court for a certificate of appealability with respect to Brady, and that wasn't the main focus of the discussion in the district court. I do think it was incorrect to say that it's a Brady issue. Now, certainly, maybe it's not incorrect in the sense of if he gets past the H1 standard and shows clear and convincing evidence of actual innocence, then we do move on to Brady. I think by that point, he also prevails, because if you meet the first test by clear and convincing evidence, you're going to meet the second test. So perhaps that's what the court had in mind. But in suggesting that you can simply have a Brady claim as the sole basis of your second or successive, clearly conflicts with the language of 2255H1, which talks about newly discovered evidence. With regard to the evidence in this case, we have argued repeatedly that the way this works is you take out Kujik and McDonald. Taking out McDonald is easy. He didn't testify. He didn't testify at the suppression hearing. He didn't testify at the trial. So that leaves you with Kujik. Kujik gave 6 pages of testimony at the trial, simply saying that he recovered one of the 2 guns in the living room. That's it. The notion that if you took out that testimony,
Kujik recovered the gun.
The other gun was recovered by Kovacs, who also recovered the key from Mr. Barrett's pocket. So if you
who saw Kujak's recover the gun from behind the TV set?
Sergeant Gorman testified that he observed the recovery of the weapons. And there I do disagree with my friend's discussion of the record. She says that he just says, in my presence, as if, you know, that means he saw everything when he really didn't. That's not what he testified. It's a page 366. He said, when any evidence is seized, it's the general practice in our squad and throughout the Narcotics Bureau, you're called to that location just simply so when we do come to court, we could say, yes, we recovered in our presence, and we could give you the condition or how it was placed. So what he's saying is, I go to the scene so I can look at it, so I can be a witness. And he did testify that the guns were, this is Gorman, testified that the guns were recovered in the living room.
But they had been recovered before he got there. If he went
actually not. He was explaining the in my presence, but he was actually present. There were 4 or 5 officers who breached the door and went in to search, and they describe it in their testimony in graphic detail. He was in that team. Gorman was in the apartment the entire time. This was his case. So if you take out Kujik, at that point, it just doesn't matter whether we're talking about the H1 standard or whether we're talking about Brady. You know, under Brady's, it's still the defendant's obligation to show a reasonable probability of a different verdict. You can't meet that either. What this case relies on is Gorman. He has never been accused or implicated in any police wrongdoing. We rely on his testimony. There's no reason for us not to. What we've seen, I think, unfortunately, in the briefing here, is just widespread accusations of guilt by association, and that's it. There's a statement in the reply brief that says any of the corrupt police officers who were conducting the search could have fabricated evidence during the search. I mean, that kind of accusation does not meet H1, it's not Brady, it's not anything other than a wild accusation against officers who've never been accused of any wrongdoing.
Well, but it wasn't notified corrupt officers. I mean, that.
Right, but there are lots of statements there. Page 16 of the reply brief says, the police officers involved in this prosecution engaged in rampant contemporaneous misconduct in drug-related cases. The defense has put forward no evidence whatsoever of any of that. In fact, they haven't even shown that these few allegations against Kujik and McDonald even took place in 2005. The case that the government brought against the other officers started in 2006. It involved a six-year course of conduct from 2006 to 2012. McDonald is sanctioned in 2014, we're told, for a single instance of making a false statement on a search warrant. Now, Kujik, we know that the allegations came earlier because we disclosed them in 2009, as I mentioned earlier. But there's been no showing that any of that took place in 2005. But I'm willing to say, take out Kujik's testimony. It's the only testimony here that could possibly be implicated. Gorman has never been implicated, and he is the key person from beginning to end. And Kovacs has never been implicated. He takes the key to Barrett's apartment, to the apartment, out of Barrett's pocket. He finds the other gun in the living room. Now, I know the defense would like to relitigate this case, but you know, and just make arguments about could Gorman really see? Was it too dark when he saw the trash bowl? But this is a second or successive 2255 motion. This is not an opportunity to relitigate a trial. When it did get litigated, and when it was brought up on direct appeal, again, it went to the panel. This is 394 Fed Appendix 866. When this court affirmed the conviction, Judge Fisher, being ubiquitous, is again on the panel. This opinion was written by Judge Randell. And let me just wrap up by reading just this one short paragraph affirming the sufficiency of the evidence. It says here, in addition to having been found in an apartment containing drugs and packaging material in plain view in the kitchen and guns hidden in the living room, Barrett had a key to the apartment in his pocket. He was observed by the police disposing of trash from the apartment that was found to contain drugs and drug packaging paraphernalia, and he fled to the second floor when the police arrived to execute the warrant. Every single word of that paragraph that was written by this court depends on the testimony of Gorman and Kovacs and no one else. There is nothing there that even relies on Kujik's testimony, and this court held that was sufficient to uphold the verdict. If that's true, then certainly nobody could say that this new information about Kujik many years later would lead no reasonable juror to convict the defendant, or even that there's a reasonable probability of a different result. It just doesn't work that way. Now, I guess the only other factual matter that I should address involves the question of Gorman seeing Mr. Barrett. The defense has said, well, no, that was McDonald. McDonald's the one who saw him when he did the trash pull, and therefore you needed McDonald. Well, obviously the government didn't think it needed McDonald because it didn't even call him as a witness at trial. But in fact, Gorman testified that he personally saw it. Page 401 of the appendix, he actually got a little bristled on cross-examination. And he said, I viewed the person that is your client seated over there in the blue jacket in the suit when he was down at the bottom. And I knew him by face, and immediately upon seeing him, when I did the warrant, I knew that to be him, the man that came out on that day. And we just can't relitigate that now. It was argued in front of the jury. The defense had their witness. They called the girlfriend who said, no, this was the only time Barrett was ever in the apartment. Jury rejected it. This court found the evidence sufficient. There is no new evidence whatsoever that would meet either the H1 standard that applies or the Brady standard. And for that reason, we believe the court should affirm.
Thank you, Mr. Clausen. You reserve some time, Ms. Ward?
Yes, 3 minutes, Your Honor. Will you warn me when I'm done?
Well, are we a warning or a sudden stop?
Okay, understood. I believe Mr. Zosmer misspoke. This court, as I acknowledged in the opening, has applied H2. to 2244. That's the Peppers case, for example, but not H1. The H1 cases that the government cites are 2254 cases. For example, the First Circuit and Marino Morales, let me give you that cite, 334 F3rd 140, is an example of a circuit court that has applied Brady and not apply the clear and convincing evidence standard at a second 2255. Second, the government emphasizes, to quote, that we have no evidence. But Mr. Barrett didn't have an evidentiary hearing. The district court denied him that. And the papers here do not conclusively show that he's not entitled to relief, because the proposal that the government is making is deeply troubling, that it can rely on supervisors who relied on other officers who were engaged in conduct that was involved fabricating and planting evidence.
So they're making that assertion. They're basically saying that there was more than one officer on the scene available to testify, and who in fact did testify. Some of the officers on the scene, particularly one, Kujak, was subsequently discovered to be planting evidence and engaged in all kinds of reprehensible unethical conduct. But there are other officers on the scene who were not engaged in that, who saw and testified to the exact same thing.
And we know that that's wrong, because Officer Gorman testified about all of the evidence. And this was a multi-room apartment. It was a multi-floor apartment building. And he did not see all of that evidence being recovered. And the defense had no idea that it needed to probe what he meant at the time. The last point I'd like to make is about the direct appeal. Mr. Barrett challenged the sufficiency of the evidence as to the second trial in his direct appeal, the gun that was allegedly found in the car. He has now served his 10-year custodial sentence, and here we are more than 10 years later, and the government refuses to defend that verdict. The government, though, defended the verdict at the time.
What consecutive sentence? Where does that get you?
On the second trial, if we do not get relief on the first trial, then we are not seeking a remand as to just the second trial, based on the concurrent sentence case law that's cited in the government's brief. But I want to emphasize that the government has said over and over, there's not enough evidence here, there's not enough evidence here. But now it concedes that when it defended those officers and cited to their testimony to this court, it can no longer defend those officers. And we simply ask that what happened at the second trial not happen at the first trial, and that at the very least we get a remand for an evidentiary hearing so that the court can hear the evidence and issue a reasoned decision.
What would be the evidence that you want to present? That's what I'm not. Do you want to establish that Gorman really wasn't in a position to see what he said he saw when the gun was recovered, or they didn't see, or couldn't have ID'd the defendant during the trash pull? Or what is it that you're trying to, what's the evidence you want to bring out?
Yes, Your Honor, we would determine what Gorman saw recovered versus what he learned from the case reports from the other officers, and what was hearsay that's inadmissible.
Mr. Zosman did the trash pull. Mr. Zosman just read from the record, the kind of question that I imagine any lawyer hates to get in response to an answer. I mean, any answer you hate to get in response to a question where the witness gets upset and just totally blows your way by saying, I saw your client. He went out, he pulled the trash. It was him, the guy sitting right there next to you. I'm not sure what you want to be litigating about that. And maybe the gun's different.
It is impossible that Gorman saw all of the evidence being recovered from the apartment. So reading the testimony end to end that Gorman gave, he could not physically, he could not have possibly seen all of that in this multi-room apartment with multiple floors.
What he needs to have seen is the gun. And to the extent that he sees the trash ball, that verifies or corroborates the constructive possession and the key coming out of the pocket. And that's strong corroborative evidence, isn't it? As to whether or not he has dominion over that apartment and where the gun is found?
No, Your Honor. I mean, the Miss Ayers, who I think Mr. Zosmer misspoke, was not Mr. Barrett's girlfriend, but she was the woman in the apartment. She testified that the key was hers. And so we would call her, we would call other.
And I give someone else my key to access my house. I have dominion over the house of the other person because they've just given it to me. I'm not sure that negates constructive possession, especially when you add into it exercising control via the trash pool. But you know,
it doesn't.
Time's up, and we're getting kind of circular. There's a final point you want to make. I don't want to preclude you from making it. Go ahead.
Thank you, Judge McKee. The jury had to assess the officer's credibility here. Reviewing the government's brief, it seems like this was an open and shut case. But once you actually look at the testimony, this was not an open and shut case. And we ask that Mr. Barrett's convictions be vacated. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Counsel. I thank both counsel for the very helpful argument. Take the matter under advisement. And,